as Simon said, we're in Genesis. We're in week 11 of week 12 of the series. I've loved it, actually. I've just so thoroughly enjoyed just seeing God breaking through in the narrative of Genesis. And we are this week going to be in chapter 38. Next week, we're going to be finishing off with the story of Joseph, which is a massive section of Genesis. So, Chris Kimbangi, you might remember some of you, Chris Kimbangi. He's going to be coming back and finishing off our series. He leads the church in Guildford. He used to be an elder here at Grace Church. And so he's going to be finishing off our series next week. And as we've gone through the series, you may have noticed something. Well, I hope you have, and I hope it's become clear in our preaching, is that this is about the origin of God's family. It's the origin story and the narrative of God's family and how it comes to climax into with Jesus at the end. But you may have noticed they're not great people, to be honest. We often think of Noah and all of those heroes and Abraham and people like that, and we're like, oh, they're superheroes. And we have seen that this family is very much not a superhero family. They are very much a broken and messy bunch. The beautiful thing of Genesis is that God will save the whole cosmos through this family. He works it for his salvation purposes through one particular family member. We've seen that the family so far is a lying, hateful, hypocritical, unjust, two-faced, murderous, adulterous, incestuous, polygamous, misogynistic, arrogant, deceptive, vindictive, compromising, self-promoting, greedy, lazy, using, abusing type of family. That's what we've seen so far. And you think, oh, they couldn't really get much lower. Oh, yes, they can. Don't worry. We're in Genesis 38 today, and it seems like they go to an all-new low in the story today. It's got no spotless characters, and we're looking at the story of Judah and Tamar. And if you were to read your Bible in order, so we've such a big book, we've taken chunks and we're looking at different characters, but the Judah and Tamar story, it seems to interrupt the flow of the Joseph story. It's like it's just been plonked in there. It's like, well, I don't know why that's there. It's a really odd story. It disrupts the flow of Joseph, and it's quite a shocking story. It involves a very powerful man, Judah, and he is and his disregarding the well-being of a powerless woman in the story, and yet God in it, just as we've seen with all the stories, God works through the woman and the man to bring about his saving purposes. So this is a long story. We're going to read it all because it just really frames the story really helpfully. But as we read it, I want you, if you're a man this morning, I want you to read this through the eyes of the woman. I want you to ensure that your perspective is through the eyes of Tamar in this story. So I'm going to read a bit, pause and explain a little bit just to make sure you're following along, and then we'll come back to the story. And so as we read through it, that's what we'll do. So we're going to be in Genesis 38, verse 1. At that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with the man Abdullam, named Hera. There, Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her, and he loved her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son, who was named Ur. Just be careful when you call your child. What do you want to call him? Not sure. She conceived again and gave birth to a son, and his name was Onan. She gave birth to another son and named him Shelah. It was in Kezib that she gave birth to him. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's son, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so he put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. Just pause there. So, it was normal in the culture of the time that if a brother was to die and there was no offspring, was to, if there was another male, was to provide him with a child. It was customary to do that, and that would protect the woman. So this was to protect Tamar, but it was also to protect the line, the descendants as well. So let's go from verse 9. But what did he do? But Onan knew that the child would not be his, very selfish. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the floor to avoid providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought he may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. So what's happened? Judah's got married and he's had three sons. He's got his three sons. The first son is wicked and evil and he dies. He's married to who marries Tamar, and so he's wicked and dies. So he's got. So he, then Tamar goes to the other son, as was customary, and he does the thing that is wicked and evil there as well. He doesn't want the family line to continue. He doesn't want to protect Tamar, and so he dies. And so there's one son left, and he's Judah is saying, well, he's too young. You can't marry him just yet. And that wasn't really customary. What Judah is ultimately saying is tough luck. Tough luck, you're on your own. Judah thinks this is a reason to... he thinks that his dying sons is happening because of her rather than actually seeing that his sons are actually evil. So far in her life, Tamar has lost two husbands and she's just been run over by life. She's just in a place where it's just painful for her. It's so important we read it through her eyes and see that. Imagine how she feels. Imagine what point that she has got to here. Okay, so we're going to go from verse 12. Let's see what she does. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. But Judah had recovered from his when Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah. To the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went with him. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothing, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had not grown up. She had not been given to him as his wife, like he was meant to be. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was the daughter-in-law, he went over to the roadside and said, come and sleep with me. She's dressed as a prostitute. Why? A bit odd. Well, she's probably seen a bit of his pattern of behavior. There seems to be a pattern of behavior in Judah that she recognizes, and then she comes up with this plan of dressing that way. Let's see what happens there. When Judah saw her, we're going further down. Verse 17. I'll send you, so this is Judah speaking to her, I'll send you a young goat from my flock, he said. What will you give me as a pledge? I don't trust you that you're going to send this goat. All right, you're pretty deceptive. So, I want a bit of evidence. So, this is what he says. What will you send something as a pledge until you send it? She asked him. He said, "What pledge should I give you? Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand." She answered. So he gave them to her, and he slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Why did he give her those things? Well, it's like your phone keys and wallet. She's planning something here. She's come up with an idea of, all right, I can see you probably aren't going to send me this goat that you said you're going to send me. You're pretty deceptive. So let's see what, if her plan, she's taken it, let's see what her plan is to do with it. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. Wonder where this prostitute could have gone to. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There hasn't been a shrine prostitute here," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her." Besides, the men who lived there said, "There hasn't been a shrine prostitute there." Then Judah said, "Let her keep what she has, or we will be a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but I didn't find her." About 3 months later, after Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant," Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned to death." He's being slightly hypocritical here. He's probably aware that it's him. He's probably aware that it's all there. And he's like, he can sleep with whoever he wants. He can do whatever he wants. He's a man of power, a man of authority. He can do anything that he likes. He can sleep with whoever he likes. But now, the moment's come, he's got caught. He's been found out. Bring her here so we can burn her. He knows what's happened, and his only way is to then just get rid of her. That's what he's planning on doing. And as she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these things." Wonder what they are. And she said, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff this is." Whose phone keys and wallet are these? I can't work it out. Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. Her plan has worked. She's not going to be destroyed. She's not going to be broken anymore. And he realizes his hypocrisy. And then finally, when the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. As she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand. So the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on his wrist and said, "This one came out first." But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out. And she said, "So this is how you have broken out." And he was named Perez, really important name. Then his brother, who had a scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was named Zerah. A very, very interesting story. A story of abuse. A story of manipulation. And we can ask the question, what on earth is this in the Bible? Why has God put this in the Bible? We can think, how on earth is this supposed to speak to us? We think, should we copy Judah? Should we copy him and just sleep with prostitutes and everything will be fine? Or be like Tamar and trick him into sleeping with her? Obviously, neither of those are true. Neither of those are right. I want to pick out three things that we can learn from this passage, and each one we'll look at Judah and we'll look at Tamar. So first thing is, God uses broken people. That's the story we have seen throughout Genesis, and it's really clear here. Both Judah and Tamar, they are broken, but you see that they're in the lineage of Jesus. They are important people. These broken people are in the lineage of Jesus. They've been waiting since Genesis 3 for a snake crusher. Been waiting for it. This seed who's going to come and defeat sin and death and restore the whole cosmos. Where's he going to come from now? Because there's no descendants. Judah's got no descendants now coming because of his actions. It comes from this messy story. It comes from this broken people. And despite being broken people, God uses them. God uses them to bring the whole cosmos to himself through Jesus years and years later. But despite being broken, God used them. How? Let's look at Tamar first. God uses broken people, including people who have been broken by others. Just like Tamar. Tamar was broken by Judah. Judah, he is a powerful individual. He is somebody who is in a position of power. He is in a position of influence. And he is completely blind. He is in complete denial that that anything has happened. Verse 11 demonstrates that he is convinced himself that she was the problem. That his sons, no, my sons were fine. No, they weren't. They were evil. His sons were evil. Tamar's perspective and her position at this point is a place of utter hopelessness. She's in a complete and utter hopeless situation. She is oppressed. She is utterly finished. She is completely powerless. That is the position she is in. If it were left to Judah, what would have happened is that seed that they're waiting for, that line for the snake crusher, it would have been finished. He's saying, no, we don't need a descendant. It would have finished in that moment, but Tamar steps up. Tamar steps in with her plan, and she uses the only thing she's got against a powerful man. What do you think it is? She uses her superior intelligence. She outwits the man. And you know what? This is a common thing. This is common within the Bible, that the woman uses her superior intelligence to bring God's salvation plan. You see it in the story of Rebekah and Isaac. You see it in Rachel and Laban last week. You see it with the Hebrew wives. So in Exodus, so the next book of the Bible, Moses is saved because of the intelligence of the woman. And we see it, I think, most primarily in Esther. So in the book of Esther, with her husband Xerxes, she uses it to save the whole of the Israelite nation. God uses the woman's intellect to shame the stupid man. Praise God for women. And it is, yeah, we should be applauding that. It's not just that Tamar pulled her way out of oppression. She's not done it all. Yeah, God used her to lift her from her lowly state. The Bible is not excusing her behavior. How she behaved probably wasn't the most godly way, but it points to something that it talks about in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 28. God chose the lowly things, the things of this world, and the despised things, and the things that are not, to nullify the things that are. However powerless, however hopeless you feel, or your previous situation has been, or if you are a victim of great injustice, if you just are in a place where you feel like, I've got no future, I've got nothing. If you have been hurt too many times, wherever you are, whatever has been done to you, however broken you are, you need to know that God sees you. You need to know that you are not too broken for God. There is nobody that is too broken for God. God uses broken people. It's beautiful. He has a plan. God uses broken people. God uses people that have been broken by others. He also uses those who break others. So Tamar was broken by Judah. Judah is the one who breaks her. Judah is the oppressor. What do I mean by broken people who break others? God can use them. We love the idea that God uses broken people. He lifts the lowly. We love that sentiment. We love that idea. We love the truth of it. And it's a great and beautiful truth. But God can use the oppressor. That's a much more bitter pill to swallow. In this scenario, this is Judah. Judah is the oppressor. But he's used massively by God. He becomes the most powerful tribe later on in the Bible. His grandfather, his great-great-grandfather, is King David. Like he's the top king. He is the king of kings type of character. He's so good. And it ends up that the only tribe left when they go into captivity is Judah. Judah is the only tribe left. So much so that the place is called Judah. That's what it's called. Where, what tribe does Jesus come from? Jesus comes from the tribe of Judah. History is shaped by Judaism. History will end when every knee will be bowing to the Lion of the tribe of Judah. God uses the broken people who do the bad stuff. It's common in the Bible and throughout history. This is where the bitter pill comes in. We are like Judah. You and I, we are all like Judah. The reality is we are all broken in this sense. That's who we are. We are all broken in that we hurt people because we are broken ourselves. We are broken. We need to realize that we are broken in this sense too. We need to realize that we have the ability, just like Judah, to break things, to break people. Whatever you have done to others and yourself or yourself, you are not too broken for God to use. God uses broken people, those who are broken by others, which is some of us, and those who are broken by our sin, which is all of us. The fact is that the only thing preventing us being used is our denial to the fact that we are broken, that we are sinners ourselves. But this is then the next beautiful thing that we see in this story, that God offers breakthrough to broken people. God offers breakthrough to broken people. At the end of the story, I said, oh, Perez, that name is important. That name means breakthrough. It's telling us he is a picture of the turning around, the change in the situation for Tamar. Her life is changed. She's gone from shadows to being the great, 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 great grandma of Jesus. Her position has shifted. There is a breakthrough moment. Am I saying that her actions of sexual entrapment are acceptable? I don't think that's an easy question to answer, actually. I think the Bible provides a fascinating answer. In one sense, the answer is a clear no. And I'm not saying copy her. She is guilty and she did something wrong. But I think the line in verse 26 is really quite important. Judah realizes, doesn't he? He's like, oh, she's more righteous than I. He says, she is more righteous than I. He realizes he's done wrong. He realizes who she is. She is more righteous than I. That word righteous is a legal term. This story is an issue about justice and who has justice on their side. Judah says, justice is on her side. He has been guilty of injustice and she is on the side of justice. He realizes his hypocrisy. He has slept with whoever he wants, whenever he wants, and she's not been able to do anything. She's not totally righteous, but she is more righteous than I. She is guilty, but I am more guilty, is what he is saying. The Bible, just brings it together. Hosea 4, verse 14. I will not punish your daughters when they turn to prostitution, nor your daughters-in-law when they commit adultery. Sounds like Tamar. Because the men themselves consort with harlots, with shrine prostitutes. Justice. The man is in the position of power and authority. He should use it to work justice. But what does he do? He uses it for his own gain. He uses it for his own self-justice. He uses it for injustice. Tamar has committed adultery, but Judah has worked social injustice. She is guilty, but I am more guilty. One commentary by Alex Vargas and Christina Bonn just writes it really beautifully. The narrative neither condones nor condemns her actions, but portrays an exploited and deceived woman with a deep sense of justice and righteousness, taking matters into her own hands to make things right. In the end, this narrative points us to the demonstration of God's righteousness through the weak and the powerless, which he continued to do in her world of sin and deception. Injustice is a big deal in the eyes of God. Injustice is a huge deal. He hates injustice. In our next preaching series after Genesis, actually, is called Doing Justice. So we're going to be talking into this a little bit more and what it means for us. But Tamar, she is not spotless, but God works a huge breakthrough in her life, a real change in her life by lifting her from her lowly position. But what happens with Judah? What's the difference between the two? Judah has his own powerful breakthrough, but God works the breakthrough in bringing his life down from his lofty position, from where he was, his position of pride and power. To see it, we've got to look at his life story a little bit more. So we need to expand out from chapter 38. So in the previous chapter, we see the story of Joseph starts. He's had his dreams, and he's got he's got his coat, his little fancy coat. You may well remember the Technicolor dream coat, the singing and the dancing bit. And he's got that. And his brothers, they get jealous. And so what they do is they throw him in a pit. They think about killing him, and then they go, no, let's sell him. Let's get some money for this. It's a much better idea. And so what they do is then they pretend to their father that he is dead. They take the coat that he had, and they cover it in blood with the goat's blood, and they take it to the father. They take it to Jacob, their father. And who's the ringleader in all this? It's Judah. He's a rotten scoundrel before even 38 has begun. Like that's what he's like. He's a broken scoundrel before it's begun. But there's an interesting line that is said in the previous chapter. It says, so he's taken the bloodied coat to his father. He says, see if you recognize whose this is, says to his dad. And that is exactly the same line we hear from Tamar when she comes to him. That word recognize, it means, do you see the meaning of this? Do you see the meaning of what's happened? Your son is dead in the Joseph story. And then it comes to her. And at that moment when he is speaking to Tamar and Tamar speaks that to him, he recognizes his sin. He recognizes his injustice. He is changed. He is a man of power. What he could have done, he could have said, no, that staff and stuff, that ain't mine. That's not mine. Kill her anyway. He could have done that. That was his position. Yet, what he does, he recognizes, he repents. When she says, oh, do you recognize who this is? He's like, oh, she's more righteous than I. He's changed his position. Can we be certain, though? Could it just be that he's being nice in that moment? Or we need to go further into his life? So remember his brother Joseph, who's in the pit and gets sold? He's now in Egypt. He's now prime minister. He's now the leader in that place. And it says in chapter 42, verse 8, they've come to him because they've run out of money. They've run out of food where they live. And they come to him, and it says, although Joseph recognized his brothers, they didn't recognize him. What's happening in this moment is Joseph is framing the younger son. He's framing Benjamin because he wants the dad to come. And who comes to the rescue? Who comes in that moment? Is it going to be? It's Judah. Judah intervenes in this moment. He's saying, no, I don't want you to take my brother away. It says this in Genesis 44. Now then, please let your servant, me, Judah, remain here as my lord's Joseph's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return to his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come on my father. He has been brought low. He has recognized his sin. He has had a breakthrough moment when he realizes the stuff is his. And he's like, oh no, I'm so unjust. She is more righteous than I. He has this point, and now he's got to a point where he is willing to say, no, I will be the substitute. I will stay in Egypt while my brother can go back to his father. That's what he's doing. He's laying it aside. This morning, it might be that God needs to bring you low. Are you needing to recognize your own sin this morning? Judah is changed so much that he is willing to be the substitute. He is willing to allow his brother to go home to the father, just as someone does thousands of years later. God offers breakthrough to all broken people, including you and me. It might be in situations like Tamar, and God is a God who works miracles and he changes situations and brings restoration. It might be breakthrough in our hearts like it is for Judah, and it's available to you. Breakthrough in relationship with God, just like Judah. But the final thing is breakthrough belongs to God. Breakthrough belongs to God. So the breakthrough in a broken life, it belongs always to God. Tamar doesn't lift herself from her lowly position. God lifts her up. Judah, he doesn't just sort himself out and fix himself up. No, God works in it. For Tamar, she is sinful and guilty of the sin she is accused of, but she points to what God does in us. Despite her unjust abuse at the hands of a powerful man, she doesn't die. Her life is saved, and she goes on to be the great grandma of Jesus. And for Judah, after God changes his heart, he goes to offer and to be the sacrifice, the substitute for his brother. Points forward to Jesus, who is the great substitute. He is our substitute. And we're going to remember him in communion in a minute. So Pete, do you want to come up? We're going to worship in a second. And this series, this is important. This series, we have learned about our heart, our human heart of sin, but how it is trumped by God's heart of grace. The story of Judah and Tamar points to a breakthrough for broken people that is yet to come through the grace of God. Despite our sin or because of God's grace in Christ, we don't die. Our lives are saved. For 1 Peter 3. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. The family line in Genesis, our family line. If you're a Christian this morning, it's our family line too. It is messy. It's messed up. It is broken. But where does it find its restoration? It finds it in Christ. We may be broken, but Jesus was broken. We may experience injustice. Jesus experienced injustice. It all reaches its restoration. It all reaches its climax in him. On the cross, Jesus suffered all that we will, so that we could be just like Benjamin, brought back to the Father. And so this morning, do you want to stand? This morning, I want to provide a prayer opportunity for you. And it might be prayer for two quite painful areas, actually. You might fit in to these areas, and if you do, I want to say you need prayer this morning. You need encouragement that God uses broken people, and it might be that you have been broken by others. It might be that you are a victim of injustice, like Tamar. You might have experienced something of the injustice like Tamar. The other one might be that you have a sense of guilt by breaking others. It might not be in varying degrees. But I just feel that those two areas would be worth praying into this morning. God uses broken people. You might be broken this morning, or you might be someone who has broken another person. I just want to let you know God uses both. God offers breakthrough to broken people. And so what we're going to do, ministry time a little different to normal, actually. Often we separate communion from praying into a situation. And so I just feel this morning it right to join them together, actually. To, as we do, as we take communion, so on either side there's some stuff labelled gluten-free. If you need gluten-free, just have a look. And I just feel that there's a moment this morning as we join our prayer with communion that something happens in those moments. As we take communion, substitute really was. We remember Jesus, our substitute, and we enjoy that. And then we're praying into a situation. It reminds us of, oh, this is our position. Jesus is our substitute in those experiences that we've had. We're going to remember how Jesus was broken for us as we take communion. So I'm going to pray. And how this will work is, as I pray, join with me. And then once I finish praying, Pete's going to sing a song. I don't know what he's going to sing. He's going to sing a lovely song. All about Jesus. And what we're going to do, we're going to go and get our communion. And if anything I've spoken about this morning resonates with you, I would love you to come over to our wonderful info point over there, our new info point. It's not, just point it out, it's lovely, isn't it? But we're going to take our communion over to there, if anything I've spoken about this morning, and I'd just love to pray with you. And we're going to take communion together, and we're going to pray together, and I'll get a team of people over there, and we can do it. It'll be messy, but it's what church is. And we're going to share it together, and we're going to pray into whatever situation it is that's there. If you think, oh, this isn't for me, then grab someone near you, make sure both feel comfortable to do it, and take communion together. This is for Christians, this is for people who say, no, Jesus is Lord, Jesus is King of my life, and I want to live for Him. That's what communion is for, so that's remembering who Jesus is as Christians. That's why there's something different in it. But if anything I've spoken about, just come over there, and we're going to do communion together over there, and we'll pray into that situation at the same time. So I'm going to pray, let your communion, meet me over there, or meet with the people you're with, whoever you feel safest with. God, I just thank you in this story of injustice. Lord, you ultimately point to yourself. You point to the injustice that you suffered, that you went through on the cross, that you experienced on the cross, where you were broken. God, you were broken for us. You were broken by us, God of the universe. And Lord, as we take communion, will we remember you? Will we remember the cross, what you paid on it, what it meant, Lord, the power that it's got? And will, as we take communion, will we remember how broken we are? That it is our sin that put you on the cross. It is the wrath of God on us that you were dealt. Lord, it wasn't a wrath that you were deserving of. It was ours. We are broken people in so many different ways. And so, God, I just pray that you speak into our lives as we take communion now, as we remember you, as we celebrate the cross, as we celebrate your body broken, your blood spilled for us. Love you.